Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday morning, May the 9th. Well, Uncle Ben, the fictional rice cook, is now Ben, CEO. The ad character recently got a makeover from the food company Mars, which owns the Uncle Ben's line of rice products. After 60 years as a fictional cook who adorned the boxes of rice, Uncle Ben is now just Ben, an accomplished businessman. We're going to talk about the use of racially charged ads, the use of racial stereotypes in advertising. We're going to talk about how and why advertisers come up with these images with our first guest this hour, and then we'll get a retrospective of more of these characters with our second guest in the second half hour. And we welcome you to join in the conversation, too. Is there a character in an ad that you thought crossed the line? Are there any out there right now that offend you? Are characters like Uncle Ben or Aunt Jemima harmful or innocuous? Our toll-free number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and community with your email. Our first guest is Joyce Wohlberg. She is Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Associate Professor of Advertising and Public Relations at Marquette University's College of Communication. Good morning.
Good morning.
What I'm wondering, Professor Wohlberg, is I guess I didn't think about it until the makeover, is why did it take so long to change the image of Uncle Ben?
That's a good question, because some of the other characters have been updated slightly over the, you know, over a period of time. I don't really know. Part of the problem, I suppose, is when you when your character is actually the name of the product, you have a little less leeway than you might otherwise. And so, you know, how much do you change and still retain whatever brand equity you have built up for all these many years?
Well, so for some reason, back in 1946, the company that, I don't know if it was Mars that owned Uncle Ben products then, decided that that this African-American man with kind of looks like a servant with a bow tie was going to be a good way to sell rice.
Yes, and you know, same with Aunt Jemima and other figures, African-Americans in roles of servitude were the depictions that we saw during that era. It wasn't until the Civil Rights era in the 60s when they began to really complain about the imagery, boycott products, and get the attention of advertisers to, you know, to portray them in a different way. You know, in the 40s, when they created that product, they were not thinking of the African American consumer; they were thinking of the white consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, during that time, you know, the white population was a greater majority than it is now. And there were really only the ways of reaching people through media all were to reach a mass market. We didn't have all these targeted magazines and cable channels back then, and so your options were basically to put ads in magazines that reached a mass market, or to advertise on television channels that reached a mass market as television became more available. You know, and so. The campaigns were really not targeted, so they had the white consumer in mind.
Yeah. Then in the civil rights era, many of these companies did change their tune, or at least their ads?
A lot of the advertising changed. You suddenly saw African Americans as the consumer of products. As before, they were the domestic help, they were the maids, the elevator operators, the porters, the waiters, and so forth. And they were never the consumers. But you know, after the during the 60s, you began seeing different images where they now were the consumers. And then there, you know, there those depictions completely changed. It's taken a number of years for that to really change. It didn't happen entirely overnight, but advertisers clearly realized that they were alienating a market, getting, you know, having boycotts of their products was not good. It was not good for business.
When did I mean, I remember some news coverage of it, but the Aunt Jemima picture on the, you know, pancake boxes, pancake mix boxes, she used to have like a kerchief around her head, and now she looks more like a Betty Crocker with some pearls and such.
Right. I don't remember exactly what year that took place. It was later than, you know, as far as Betty Crocker, she got updated several times over the decades. And so much earlier on, she got updated because women were no longer necessarily stay-at-home moms, and there were more women in the workforce. And so Betty Crocker began to take on a new image that changed multiple times. And, you know, it was slower for Aunt Jemima to get a new look.
Yeah. Was it protests from, civil rights-minded groups or African-American groups that resulted in Aunt Jemima's makeover?
I'm actually not sure about that. I'd have to do some digging to find the answer to that. But, you know, over time, I think advertisers have begun to be more aware of the portrayal issues. I don't believe they were back in the 40s and 50s. There were some critiques of advertising, but it was more along the lines of critiquing sending messages of materialism, and it was about the use of media, the way advertisers used the media to gain access to an audience, and how that might compromise the content of the media. So those were the kinds of criticisms that we saw earlier on. And then, you know, during the 60s, I think this is the first time that advertisers paid so much attention to how they portrayed people. And even then, each group had to fight its own battle. So during the 60s, advertisers became more aware of how they were portraying African Americans and responded to that criticism. But they didn't. So they didn't also think, what are we doing? How are we portraying Hispanics or Native Americans or Asians? They let each group fight their own battle, and they dragged their feet on it. Mm-hmm. So that as a result, you know, you had Hispanics complaining that, you know, or you had them complaining that, you know, here we have the Frito Bandito character. How come you're depicting us in such a negative way? But you've seen the light with the African Americans.
Yeah, so. In fact, I remember that that battle. It seems to me that was in sometime in the 60s or 70s when that came out. And let's see. I'm sure our listeners will remember ads like this. Let me play the Frito Bandito ad.
Okay. Hello, boys and girls. It's me, the Frito Bandito. You know what I heard about you? I heard you want to be a Frito Bandito like me. You do? Then you must sing the Bandito song. Let's sing together. You just follow the bouncing Fritos corn chips bag. Ay, 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 ay. I am the Frito Bandito. Hey, I like Fritos.
You know, I remember kind of singing that song a little bit as a kid.
Yes.
Because it was a, you know, catchy tune, but then the Frito Bandito did go away, didn't he?
He did, and it was a very successful campaign. I mean, it sold a lot of Fritos, and so the company was reluctant to give that up, and they didn't want to give it up. And it was, you know, only after a lot of complaints that they finally did. But there again, they were looking at they weren't thinking of the Hispanic market as the primary users of the product. So they tend to think, you know, how much good is this campaign doing us in terms of sales versus the negative publicity we get and the possibly alienating the Hispanic market. And back then, the Hispanic market wasn't 15% of the population, which is what it is now. This is the largest minority group. And so they suddenly, Hispanics have a lot more clout than they might have back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. Tom in Columbus joins us. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for your program. It's interesting. I guess as a white male, what I'm kind of getting tired of in amongst friends, and I apologize for the background noise. I'm in a heavy truck. I don't think that there's anybody as far as commercials and still ads, but commercials moreover on television and such, and even radio, that are portrayed as negatively as the white male. I mean, we are consistently put down as the dumb people that can't use the right trash bag, but the wife can always find it. And, I mean, you know, there's been various groups that have brought this up, and it falls kind of on deaf ears. And, I mean, I think companies are hypersensitive to you know, the issue of stereotypical portrayals of, you know, persons of color. And I'm married to an African-American gal, and she's gorgeous. And basically, would a company necessarily have a negative spokesperson? You know, would they hope to enhance sales by this? I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, these days especially. In the past, I could see it, and it was definitely derogatory at times. But I think basically
I'm trying to think of a doofus white male who's the primary mascot or icon for a company, though. Tom, can you think of one?
Well, right off the top of my head, I guess I can't.
Yeah.
But you're
seeing them as being portrayed as doofuses just in ads for certain products.
Oh, consistently.
Yeah,
to the point even of your average sitcoms, which I don't watch a lot of.
That's not using it in advertising, which is what we're talking about now. Is there a Joyce Wolberg, is that a theme for advertisers?
Yeah, mm-hmm. He's absolutely
mm-hmm.
right
mm-hmm.
that you see more of that. And honestly, I think that the advertisers like to use humor whenever possible. And it's true that you can't make fun of, you can't use ethnic or racial humor. I mean, that just doesn't go over anymore. I mean, it might have worked at one time. I mean, if you look back in the 70s, we had the whole Jose Jimenez comedy routine, and we had Polish jokes, we had all kinds of things going on, but that's no longer acceptable. And so you can't go after, you have to be careful of what you say about minorities, you have to be careful about what you say about women, but I think they have taken the attitude that men have been privileged over time, so this is the mentality, that men have been white men have been the group that was privileged, and so now it's payback time, or that's a safe group to depict in a negative way. And I see it all the time. They are completely inept when it comes to household products in the ads,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder, I really question it too. I think that I think it's a very bad idea, and I think that, you know, anytime you alienate a consumer, I have to really question the strategy of that, because ultimately you're trying to get people to buy a product, and if you make one of your primary users feel that you're poking fun at them or humiliating them, that seems to me like a bad strategy.
Yeah. We're talking with Joyce Wolberg, Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Associate Professor of Advertising and Public Relations at Marquette University's College of Communication. We're talking about the history of racist ad characters during this hour, from Uncle Ben to the Frito Bandito. Our conversation prompted in the recent makeover of Uncle Ben. He has been transformed by his food company, Mars, from Uncle Ben the servant to Uncle Ben the CEO of the company. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your thoughts and questions on this type of advertising. In Madison, 263-1890, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Gene Purcell is in for Ben Marins this afternoon for At Issue. After 5, Gene's guest will examine how marketers manipulate parents to buy products for their children. So we'll hear more about marketing and advertising coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon when Jean Purcell is in for Ben Marins. We're talking about advertising and advertising that has used ad characters that promoted racial stereotypes like Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben and the Frito Bandito. And there were many, many others. Talking with a guest about why companies would have done this in the first place and how that is changing and has changed. But one of the changes just happened. Uncle Ben is now been promoted, and he is Uncle Ben, the CEO of his rice company. I'm going to talk a little bit about whether that was a smart marketing move with our guest Joyce Wohlberg, Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Associate Professor of Advertising and Public Relations at Marquette University. Is Mars, what do you think Mars is attempting to do here? Is this going to somehow boost the sales of the Uncle Ben rice products by doing this?
That's a good question. When I looked at the website, that was the first thing that I thought of, you know, and how is this exactly supposed to make me want to buy more rice?
Yeah.
You know, anytime you come up with a new campaign, it draws a certain amount of attention. And so, you know, attention is one thing, sales is something else. There have been plenty of campaigns that were very famous that didn't really generate sales. So that's going to be, you know, anybody's guess as to whether, you know, as to what happens as a result of that campaign. I thought it just seemed a bit contrived, to be perfectly honest. I mean, it's a fictional character, so you can make him anything you want to. So if they say now that he's suddenly the CEO, it's like, well, okay. You know, I mean, if you say so, you know, are we going to say that now Aunt Jemima's now going to become president of the United States, or what, you know, or what, mm-hmm. what do we do, you know, what are we doing? Somehow there's a story that gets told about a product, and it has to be, even though it's fiction, it still has to be believable, and it has to resonate with you on some level. And I don't know whether it does with consumers. I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
So,
do you know? And I should have looked the last time I was at a grocery store. That this also reminds me of. I'm trying to think. I remember Aunt Jemima's makeover. Now we have Uncle Ben with his makeover. There used to be a picture of an African American chef on the cream of wheat boxes.
Right. Roundest.
Is he still the icon?
I think he is. That's another product that I don't buy much.
Right, exactly.
You know,
but, so these haven't gone, I guess what my point is that they really, even though it's 2007, this hasn't gone away.
It's true. I think what has gone away is the use of African Americans in products where they weren't really part of the brand, the whole brand identity. It's hard to give up those characters when that's the name of the product, or where they're so closely tied to the product. There were African Americans used sort of gratuitously for ads for products that had absolutely nothing to do. You know, it could have been anybody in an ad. I think you see them differently now. Seeing white people being waited on or served by African Americans, you don't see that, and that was very common in in the earlier decades before the 60s. You did see that, so there have been changes, but it's more difficult when the character is part of the brand to completely get rid of them, because then you have to. You're probably looking at millions of dollars in an ad campaign over a period of time. Just as, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken became KFC, how many years did it take to accomplish that? And in my mind, they're still Kentucky Fried Chicken. You know, mm-hmm. You can retrain people, or you can try to retrain them in terms of a new brand name or a new image. It's easier to change the image than it is the name.
Yeah. We have an email from, I'm trying to, it's a long email, so I have to figure out who it's from. It's from Elaine in Glendale.
Mm-hmm.
And she was commenting on that maybe political correctness raises an interesting problem. She says, as soon as I got to work, I Googled soul food and the Food Network and got the very white Tyler Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Isn't there a black chef cooking regional favorites the way there are, say, Italian chefs or Cajun chefs? Because no one can figure out how to present him or her cooking cultural favorites without having the same problem. So she said, there are times when political correctness holds a culture back. How can we find a happy medium?
I think that, you know, the whole political correctness is just to be sensitive about portraying people in positive ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that you can't ever portray someone at all. It's just that any particular group of people becomes off limits. It's just that you want to you want to portray them in ways that are respectful to them. And sometimes you have to ask them. You know, a lot of people don't understand that the Native American mascots for sports teams would be harmful to them or offensive to them. Many of the non-natives just see it as, think that they're honoring them, and yet that's not the way most of the native people perceive that. And so it doesn't mean that you can never depict a native person ever at any time. It just means that, you know, those particular depictions are really problematic.
Mm-hmm.
They over and over and over again depict Native Americans as savages because it's the sports teams are looking for an aggressive image, so the warlike images. So that's, you know, partly that's the problem. Also, most of the sports teams don't get it right in terms of Native people. They put, for a particular part of the country, I had a Native friend who complained that the image for the Seminoles is on an Appaloosa horse, and an Appaloosa horse, there aren't any in Florida, they're not native to Florida. And so they get the symbolism wrong.
Mm-hmm.
When they just, you have non-native people putting together imagery like feathers and horses and tomahawks and things that, you know, they don't have any knowledge of the symbolism. And when you do things like that, then you really aren't very respectful of the native people. And so likewise, when you're depicting someone else, you have to think about, and sometimes you have to ask them, you know, how can we depict you in a way that is the most positive?
Right. And I know that Marquette University has had its a share of experience with that Native American mascot issue, but that's another program.
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll let it go at that. Thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Joyce Wohlberg is Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Associate Professor of Advertising and Public Relations at Marquette University's College of Communication. Joining us now is David Siegel. He writes for the Washington Post's Style section. He produced a photo essay for the website Slate.com entitled Uncle Ben, CEO, The Strange History of Racist Spokes Characters. Good morning. Oops, I'm sorry. I pushed the wrong button. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you make of Uncle Ben's makeover from cook to, I guess, CEO of the company?
Well, it's kind of surprising and kind of bold, because this is a character that was really born in another era. He was created in 1943 at a time when this archetype, which is generically known as the Uncle Tom being a kind of servile, happy butler or chef, someone happily serving white people, has no ambition, just kind of smiling and cooking. At the time in the 40s, that was there were just tons and tons of Uncle Toms. They were one of the most popular figures in American advertising. And Uncle Ben is one of only a couple survivors from that era. And you might think that a character like that had kind of outlived his usefulness. And in fact, instead, Mars decided rather than retiring Uncle Ben, they would promote him.
Mm-hmm.
And he is now part of a $20 million campaign to kind of rebrand him a little and upgrade his image. And he now is ostensibly the CEO of a company called Uncle Ben's Incorporated, and he has a wood-paneled office and a Macintosh computer and a daybook crammed with appointments and diary entries from his travels around the world. So I'm actually kind of surprised by it, but I think that the folks at Mars decided that they had invested millions and millions of dollars in Uncle Ben, and they had done that over the course of decades, and that he was a very valuable commodity, and that, in fact, most people don't understand his roots and have no idea about his origins.
Yeah. He's also going to be sharing grains of wisdom, I understand, in a playoff of the rice grains. Apparently, he's going to have tidbits of wisdom on their website. But why do you think it took so long for Mars to make the decision to promote him, if not retire him?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I imagine they just were thinking, like, we have this guy and we haven't really tinkered with him in decades. And, you know, I think that what I imagine happens, they thought, like, well, you know, should we retire this guy or go the other way and make him more prominent? And in order to make him more prominent, they would have to make him something other than a butler or a chef. And so they decided, well, we'll give him a raise and a promotion. It's kind of interesting. He didn't really get much of a wardrobe upgrade. He has a different jacket, but
he still has a bow tie, doesn't he?
He still has the same bow tie, yeah. And the bow tie is exactly the same one that he had in the 40s. And to my eyes, anyway, sort of really makes him look like he still is the chef. But that's the way he looks. He just happens to be sitting in a CEO's office.
Yeah. So is this Uncle Ben makeover, what kind of reaction is it getting from, I don't know, consumers in general or maybe the African-American community in particular?
Well, you know, I haven't seen any sales figures, so I don't know if it's succeeding for them financially. There was, when it initially was announced, there were a number of people who were kind of African-American scholars who said, you know, this is sort of awful, and it's too bad that they didn't decide to get rid of this character, and he's really kind of outlived his usefulness and is an anachronism, and even though they are trying to upgrade him, he still is what he has always been, namely an Uncle Tom. He just happens to have a different job description. But, you know, the debates about various racist spokes characters over the years, sometimes they bubble up in ways that so embarrass companies that the companies have to retire those characters. But in the case of Uncle Ben, that has not happened. And it's not happened in the case of Aunt Jemima either. She is the greatest example of the Uncle Ben's female counterpart, the Mammy. And she's been around for decades as well. And over the years, there have been protests about both Uncle Ben and Aunt Jemima. But they've kind of been restricted to a smallish group of vocal African-American activists. And because of that, I think that white buyers and buyers who are not black have never been kind of shamed into thinking, well, this would be inappropriate, this is actually offending black people. The protests about it never really went mainstream in a big enough way. And in addition to that, the folks who created these characters have been very savvy about upgrading them and fine-tuning them over the years, so that Aunt Jemima got a total makeover in 69. She stopped being an actual face of a human being and began as a cartoon. Mm. And then in 89, 20 years later, she was given yet another makeover and is now kind of a pearl-wearing grandmother.
Yeah, I noticed. You know what's funny, though, is But those makeovers were not the result of protests. That was just the company deciding to do this.
Well, I think that what they did was the initial makeover in 69 came after there were a number of protests. I mean, this is after the civil rights era, and there were a lot of people who said, you know, Aunt Jemima has to go, but never in some, you know, in a broad based way. And I think that the folks at Aunt Jemima just thought, let's stay a step ahead. And I think that's one of the explanations that we still have Aunt Jemima. They've just been sort of very strategic about changing her look.
It's funny, though, and maybe sad, that as we were discussing doing this program, I was trying to picture the Aunt Jemima box, so sitting in the production office, and I still saw that kerchief around her head. You know, it's not. It's still burned in my brain that she was dressed like the servant, like the mammy.
Yeah, but I think if you were 20 years old or 30 years old and never seen that kerchief, I would bet that you'd have no idea that Aunt Jemima began her life as a slave. She, in fact, her backstory was that she was a kind of jolly ex-slave who'd been raised on a plantation in Louisiana with a colonel who was a widower who took good care of her, and she created this self-rising pancake mix that was famous throughout the South. And in fact, there were Northerners who got a taste of her pancakes during the Civil War and came back and asked her to open a mill using her recipe, which they begged her to tell the secret of. And that's the story, and it's kind of an amazing idea that there would be a woman who is a jolly ex-slave who would be the face of any kind of product, and those are her roots. However, she's no longer anything that resembles nothing. There's no sense of that in her past, and I think that anyone who is I'd say maybe under 50 would have no idea where she came from.
I didn't know where she came from, but but in any case, let me take a short pause, remind listeners that we are talking about the history of racist ad characters, and talking about the recent news that Uncle Ben of the Rice Box fame has been promoted from Uncle Ben Cook to Uncle Ben CEO of the company. David Siegel, our guest, he writes for the Washington Post's style section. He produced a photo essay for the website Slate.com entitled Uncle Ben, CEO, The Strange History of Racist Spokes Characters. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in with maybe an ad that you remember or a question for our guest. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. According to a new poll, smoking, drug abuse, and obesity top the list of health concerns that parents have for their children. And Kathleen will talk with one of the doctors involved in this survey coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about racist ad spokes characters like Uncle Ben, like Aunt Jemima, like the Frito Bandito. Our guest produced a photo essay for the website Slate.com about the strange history of racist spokes characters. And I do want to go to the phones, David Siegel, but I'm just wondering, what was the difference with the Frito Bandito campaign? We did talk about that with our first guest this half hour, that there was such an outcry over that particular ad that that campaign was dropped.
You know, it's a really fascinating story. They launched Frito-Lay launched the Bandito in 67, and this was around the time when racist spokes characters were kind of in disrepute. But the one archetype that kind of grew with some fame was the kind of oily Mexican rebel, and there were tons of them all over TV and in magazines. And the Frito Bandito was kind of the ultimate expression of this, and he was backed in a huge promotion during 67, 68, 69, and a group formed called the Mexican Anti-Defamation Committee, Mexican-American Anti-Defamation Committee, excuse me, and they made put the Frito Bandito in its crosshairs and decided this was it. They had to draw the line at the Bandito, and they kind of enlisted lots of politicians, and they protested to TV stations. They got many TV stations to refuse to run Frito Bandito ads. They got some of the media interested, and over the course of a few years, they managed to create enough hubbub that there was actually Senate hearings about racist spokes characters on television, and the Frito Bandito was kind of the star, the anti-star of that two-day hearing. And shortly after that, Frito-Lay realized that as much money as they were making from the Frito Bandito, because kids loved him, it was not worth it anymore, and they quietly retired him.
Let's take some calls. Greg in New Craig, Minnesota is with us. First, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Very good.
I just wanted to chime in a little and kind of maybe ask. I'm not sure about the race element and how come it becomes one when you put a black face or a white face on a product. And I think the argument is, well, he's a chef or he's a butler or he's this or that. But I think, I guess if you are a company that puts out certain products and you take a person or a label or something, like, for instance, Tony Sachery, he's on Creole seasoning, and he's a white person, and then there's Mrs. Butterworth, and she's kind of the cook or the servant, I suppose, if you want to go that route, whether they have a handkerchief or this or that. And I'm a 30-year-old person. I never gave it any thought as to anybody's name on anything until you came up with this program, but I guess I'm not. I have a hard time finding where anybody, whether it's a white person or a black person or a native person, finds, you know, takes offense to something where, if it's a blatant something with a picture of somebody doing an awful thing or something, yeah, that's different. But to put a person's smiley face on a product, I think should be just fine, whether they're black, white, Asian, or otherwise.
What about that, David Siegel?
Well, I think that reflects the thinking of most people who, the image itself, all of these images themselves are at least now pretty banal. You know, there's absolutely nothing offensive about the image taken, say of Aunt Jemima taken on. She looks like a middle-aged, middle-class black woman. What's interesting is her history. And that's the for some people is the problematic part.
Yeah, I was going to say Mrs. But I was just trying to think Mrs. Butterworth, a syrup a bottle is a cook of some sort, but you don't know if she's black or white, do you?
I don't know about Mrs. Butterworth.
Yeah,
but I mean I think that what gives the a character like Aunt Jemima her resonance and her controversy is her roots. You know, you have to go back and appreciate that, you know, the image of the mammy was this very useful way, this very useful archetype for whites in the South, because it was really kind of an implicit argument for segregation. The idea was that, look, the mammy and the Tom are always smiling, they're always kind of delighted, and the kind of subtext was, look, if segregation is so bad, why are these people so happy? What is wrong with Jim Crow if everyone here is just really delighted to be an ambition-free servant? And that obviously was a message that that black people didn't like at the time. And I think like many other symbols of the past, it's not something that they want to see, say, in the supermarket.
Dan in Eau Claire is with us next. Hello, Dan.
Hi. There's a couple of things. I really feel like the advertising in the last 15, 20 years has empowered blacks, and I point to the big shoe contracts that Michael Jordan picked up and a number of other black athletes. But more important, I believe it was a company, Staples, that got into, they had some problems. Do you remember the what they put out, the rubber band man? Where they had the black fella that delivered office supplies around a large corporation, and they played the rubber man.
Yeah,
they were going to try to run a white guy doing that, and they got a whole lot of grief about it because that's a black song. They were told. I just want to hear your comment on that.
I'm not really sure about that. What the particulars are, but I gather that there was a black character who was dancing to the Rubber Band Man, and then they tried to do a white version of it. Is that what happened?
I think what he was saying is that they were going to put a white person in that role because it was like an office delivery boy, and rather than be accused of putting a black character in that role and being considered racist for doing that, but then they got grief that no, you should, that's an African American song, so you should put an African American in the ad. That's what Dan is saying happened.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, again, the problem with these things is ordinarily their history rather than anything else. And so, I mean, you know, if there was nothing, that seemed historically transgressive about that the character as a black guy who was dancing, who was delivering office products, then I can understand why there are people saying like this is just stupid to have a white guy doing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is an ad from I don't know what year, but it's a Jell-O ad. And this was really, targeting the Chinese, stereotyped in this commercial. This, you won't be able to see the ad, but it's a baby trying to eat Jell-O with chopsticks. And here's that ad.
Back to present ancient Chinese pantomime, just for fun of it, Jell-O tonight. Back to present small Chinese type baby waiting for dessert. Chinese mother bling baby, Jell-O, famous Western delicacy. Poor Chinese baby. He unable to tell if this Jell-O is strawberry, raspberry, jelly, orange, lemon, lime, apple, black raspberry, black jelly, or grape. Jell-O come in all 10 flavors. Poor Chinese baby. But Chinese mother bling baby, great Western invention, spoon. Spoon was invented for eating Jell-O. Baby fine, this is grape Jell-O. Deep, dark, delicious new flavor. Chinese baby very happy. So end ancient Chinese pantomime. Is pretty good commercial, no?
No.
I think they invented a new flavor called Glape.
Glape, yeah. They had that whole thing with the R's throughout that entire thing. Wow.
Yeah.
So there was others on your website display, too, that were, what was the one about the Kool-Aid? It wasn't Kool-Aid, but it was Pillsbury Kool-Aid or something. And talk about the Chinese stereotypes.
Well, that was what you're referring to is a thing called Funny Face, which was a reaction to Kool-Aid. I think it was Pillsbury's attempt to get into that market. And they launched Funny Face in 1964, and they had a bunch of different flavors. And one of them was Chinese cherry, and the other one was Indian orange. And those were two of the maybe five or six flavors that they started. And the drawings on those packets were just ridiculous. Ridiculous cliches and stereotypes and a little bit belittling. And what happened was the next year in 65, those two flavors were quietly retired and changed to something more banal.
I remember the choo-choo cherry. I remember that one.
choo-choo cherry is what replaced Chinese cherry or Chinaman cherry. I'm not sure what it was, but... I think that what was happening there is that was right around the time that this whole thing began to change. I think that the civil rights movement really was responsible, but it no longer was okay to present caricatures like that. As for the stereotypes about the Chinese, they actually are really, really old. And one of the first slides in the slideshow that I did comes from the turn of the last century. And the most vicious ad that I came across, which was an ad for a pesticide called Rough on Rats, and it was an ad of a Chinese guy in a really stereotypical Chinese Confucian outfit eating a rat, and apparently it capitalized on the then popular stereotype that Chinese people ate rats and therefore would be good to have around in any place that was rat-infested.
Oh,
and what it reflected was this incredible xenophobia at the time and this really deep sentiment against Chinese immigrants, especially out west, where they were treated basically like blacks. There were lynchings and there were laws against immigration from China. And one of the interesting things about this world is the way that you can kind of tell what was going on with race relations in this country just by looking at the ads, and that really suggested how much anger there were towards Chinese people at that time. And then you get up to the ad that you just ran, and it sort of gets softer and less vicious, but takes on other qualities of ridiculousness and condescension, I think might be a good word.
We'll go to Nick in Milwaukee next. Hi, Nick.
Good morning. Kind of interesting. I'd like to pick up on the Aunt Jemima controversy here that he was mentioning. I always thought that Aunt Jemima was a positive character, much along the lines of Rosie the Riveter or Betty Crocker, and that during the 60s, the culture of the protest movement kind of made her a character of ridicule and a demeaning character, much like Betty Crocker has sort of been, you know, a laughable middle-class person in a way. I wasn't aware of Aunt Jemima's slavery roots, but still and all, isn't that a positive image of what's degrading about a former slave, you know, doing well, you know, making good on her recipe and being a savvy businesswoman and so forth, sort of like this makeover Uncle Ben, it would seem.
Mm-hmm. What's degrading about that, David Siegel?
Well, Aunt Jemima, as she's constituted today, of course, is completely unmoored from any of her history. And there's no way that the woman on the box now could have grown up on a plantation in pre-Civil War Louisiana, because she looks to be about 55 years old. So we're talking really about the way that she was conceived, and then the way that she was portrayed for the first, say, 50 years, 60 years of her life, when she was this ex-slave, and she had been asked by some Northerners to oversee production of her pancake mix. And she would travel around the country being portrayed by a handful of women who really made their careers representing Aunt Jemima. And she was this mammy who spoke in this kind of, kind of slave English of the time. If you saw Gone with the Wind, you know from the woman who played the maid exactly what Aunt Jemima sounded like. And she had a residence in Disneyland, of all places, and she would walk around and say things like, "Lordy, lordy, they show love my pancakes." And, a lot of black people at the time thought that this is a really, really outdated portrayal of a black woman. There weren't a lot of mammies left in the 20s, 30s, and afterwards, but long after they had vanished, there was Aunt Jemima, one of the most visible black women in the country. And, African-Americans were understandably upset that that was the most prominent image of a black woman.
Yeah, we're almost out of time, but I did want to touch on one that happened in the 90s. This was the beer with the Crazy Horse beer. That didn't last long, did it?
I think it lasted about 7 years. What it was is actually a malt liquor called Crazy Horse Malt Liquor,
mm-hmm.
and it was created by a company, I think it was Stroh's Brewing Company, came up with it. Their marketing told them that that the market for malt liquor was mostly blacks and Hispanics who enjoyed images of power. This is what the market research said. So they decided that they would capitalize on Crazy Horse, and Crazy Horse actually, of course,
right. And I'm sorry I didn't give you enough time to really answer that question. People can go check it out on Slate.com, though. Thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome.
David Siegel writes for the Washington Post Style section. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.